You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
The inaugural Times Higher Education Young Universities Summit with Plymouth University took place at the Fontainebleau Hotel, Miami Beach, Florida, on the 28th of April 2014. My name's Chris Parr, and this podcast contains several short interviews with the keynote speakers from the event, starting with Dr. Jamil Salmi, Global Tertiary Education Expert and former World Bank Tertiary Education Coordinator. So I'm with Jamil Salmi, our first keynote speaker. One of the points you made was that creating a new university is arguably an easier way to create a world-class university than merging existing institutions. Why is it, do you think, that mergers can be so problematic?
Well, mergers is a bit like a marriage. You know, you have two different personalities. So in the case of universities, you have two different institutional cultures. And sometimes, so by definition, it is difficult, because you have people used to working together and working also with their own habits and processes and incentives and mission and vision, and all of a sudden they have to cohabit or to work together, to coexist with a different set of people with their own mission. So, and if I can backtrack also, how is the merger initiated? You know, sometimes there is strong government pressure for a merger, or sometimes it's decided by the two heads of the institutions without necessarily consulting with the academic community or the administration, people working in administration, or even the students. So if the merger is perceived as being imposed, it makes it also more difficult. So the best approach or the best situation would be where really the two academic communities and the leadership of the two institutions really identify complementarities and see the interest in working and bringing their two institutions into one institution. In that case, it can work much better than in the other cases.
You gave a couple of examples. I think Russia, you said, was an example of a country where there had been some forced mergers that hadn't worked. Other places, I think in France, you said there had been mergers that resulted in huge institutions that were became too unwieldy.
The mergers in France are very recent, and in some cases the newly created institutions are still very small or manageable, so that's not an issue. But there are a few cases where you all of a sudden have an institution with more than 100,000 students, and there I think that it is really challenging, because it's like managing a small city or a medium-sized city. It becomes unwieldy. Other examples, China has had also many mergers, and some of them have been total failures, others have been more successful.
Dr. Salmi, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
So I'm joined now by Sungmo Kang from KAIST. One of the things you spoke about in your keynote was how a focus on grade point average was perhaps restricting some of the creative tendencies of your students. Why was the focus causing problems, and what did you do to change it?
I think intention was good for students to work hard and then, you know, to perform well, but side effect was rather negative. Students were afraid of falling below the threshold value, and instead of taking challenging courses, they tended to take easy courses so that they can achieve a higher GPA.
Sure.
And which was counterproductive, actually. So we removed that criteria and instead lowered the GPA threshold value so that they are not obliged. They are not focusing on just getting higher GPAs. So this way they are encouraged to take more challenging courses and learn deeper. And at the same time, we are saying that it's okay for you to fail when you take very challenging courses. So we encourage them really to think deeply and learn deeply. And I think you can be more creative if you know more rather than shallow things.
Sure. And their scholarships were tied to their performance.
So
this is why they were so nervous about
exactly,
taking the challenge.
Exactly. And it was also very disgraceful if they were labeled to be a student who failed meeting a requirement, and so they were very afraid of such a failure. These students have been very successful, you know, thus far, and then suddenly if they say, you know, if they have to tell their parents that, gee, Dad, you know, I failed at KAIST and the DOS, I have to now pay, then it's much graceful. So students didn't want to have that situation. So instead of taking challenging courses, so they were taking easier courses so that they can maintain a GPA.
I'm with President Umran İnan, president of Koç University in Turkey. He started in 1993, so very much one of the 100 under 50. A remarkable presentation. You were talking about how you run the university and how you established it in the beginning. When you started departments, you didn't have heads of departments. Why did you set up in that sort of different way? And you know, what's it allowed you to do that perhaps other universities can't?
Well, it's interdisciplinary thinking. I think most of the time, established departments tend to build walls around them. Then it becomes easy, very, very difficult to penetrate. And the departments become entities that then are wanting to maintain themselves. And this restricts both development of the departments. For example, the number of faculty in each department as you go in many years, things change, priorities change. And also it prevents effective interaction between departments. Not having the department chair allows the dean to fully explore both of these opportunities.
Mm-hmm. And you had a slide up there that I tweeted actually that showed you get to 60 applicants per place when you advertise. And one of the reasons I imagine for that is the extraordinary freedom that you give faculty. I think in one line you said you act like a startup, we have no rules.
Yes.
So you really do let academics get on with what it is they want to do, but you must have to keep them in check a little bit.
We keep them in check because they are appointed every 3 years. They don't have tenure. They are evaluated academically in terms of scholarly productivity every 3 years or every 5 years. So, but for example, when they take a sabbatical leave, in terms of where they go and how they do it, we provide them full freedom because we don't know what is good for them better than they do themselves. So we say, look, we'll evaluate you in 5 years in terms of your scholarly productivity. Get there however which you, way you may want to get there. And that, I think, allows us to fully exploit all the motivation and wherewithal that the individual has in themselves. And we have hired that individual with the highest bar and in competition with a lot of applicants. So obviously he has a lot of, or she has a lot of potential. So that allows us to exploit it.
Sure, sure. And one final question very quickly. You said maybe the most stubborn problem that your experience at your institution is the recruitment of PhD students. So the next generation of young researchers, really.
Exactly.
They are. You feel that they are in some way still swayed, still romanced by the idea of an established traditional university.
Exactly. So I think the best graduates in Turkey, for example, of universities strive to go outside to established universities elsewhere. And even though some of the places that they go to arguably would not have the quality of faculty or facilities that we provide, and certainly don't have the free environment in which we provide for interdisciplinary interaction with all of it, our schools, especially the medical school. But we can't fight this. I mean, we are fighting it little by little, making headway, but also we are massively recruiting internationally.
So do you have any solutions to that problem at the moment, or is it just a...
No, I think in time it'll solve itself, because in time, as our graduates begin to tell the story of how excellent the research is at Koç University, then more people will come to Koç University. So that can only be solved in time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I'm with Cohen Lambert, Vice Chancellor of the University of York, who's just come off the stage. A great speech. One of the jokes that seemed to be running through it was that this year, of course, you're not eligible for the 100 under 50 CHE University rankings by no other virtue other than the fact that you become 51 years old. I mean, is that just an arbitrary age, or is it something that you look at in your role and think, okay, this is a turning point. We are going, as has been said here, from being a young institution to one that's a bit more established, a bit older.
Yes, of course it's arbitrary, but I think that the university is now of a size and a level of coverage and excellence in that coverage that really makes it look more like a mature and established institution, and so that it, which then also implies, of course, that it has to look at itself in that light and start behaving that way. So what I said in my talk was that being young really can no longer be used as an excuse not to do certain things very well. For instance, we really have to behave like a mature university, established university, with a very clear sense of purpose, and that's where we are. But of course, whether you're 50 or 51, when you get that sense of transition, is arbitrary.
Sure. But you said in your speech that young universities do have a lot of advantages over their older rivals, if you like.
I think the big challenge for us is to sort of keep cultivating those values that we had from when we were established, and that allowed the university to become so successful. You know, its flexibility, its commitment to its inclusivity, and its opportunity for all, and so forth. So we should not lose sight of those, and at the same time try to embed them in an institution that is mature, you know, and I can really now, in its next phase, take on the challenge of competing with very well-established top universities in the UK and beyond.
Mm. And one of the ways you're doing that is with this new approach to research in the university. Do you say a few words about that?
Yes, it's part of a university strategy that we are developing. It's an attempt to consider issues like the ones that we just mentioned in a broad context. And so we're going to have a dialogue within the university about what our priorities are in our core mission areas, you know, in research, in teaching, and how we're going to develop according to those priorities. So we'll be asking some very big questions about the size of the university, the shape, the range of activities we should be involved in, the balance of those activities. And so the question about how the university sort of defines itself and how it retains some of the, you know, the values and the characteristics that made it successful in the first place is going to be key to that discussion.
So I'm joined by Professor Wendy Purcell, Vice Chancellor and President of Plymouth University. A fantastic event, the inaugural Young Universities Summit, of course, in partnership with your institution. What were the big sort of messages that you took away from today's intensive day, but a very entertaining day?
So the Times Higher Education Young University Summit with Plymouth University has been a really compelling expression, I think, of confidence about the sector. So we've taken the top 100 universities who are all at different ages in terms of their birth certificate, but what joined us all together in that room was a sense of ambition. Mm. A sense of ambition to serve society in the broadest construct. So you saw universities talking about how they were connecting what they were doing to their place across the globe, driving social prosperity, driving economic prosperity, creating research and linking that to jobs creation. There was a real sense of not being hidebound by sort of centuries of tradition that somehow would get in the way of innovating for social purpose. And I think what the Times Higher Education has done is shone the spotlight on probably the most dynamic sector and section of the higher education sector. And what I found very compelling about the Young University Summit was the generosity of the speakers to share their stories and to help others catch up, or we heard a phrase, leapfrog, and really be very generous about their journeys and sharing with each other. And I think what we created was a cohort of universities joined by their sense of ambition, joined by their sense of boldness, who are going to genuinely disrupt the higher education sector in a way that's so powerful at a transformational level on a global stage. And that's what's happened today in the Young University Summit, is we've drawn together those dynamic global players, and they genuinely will change the world. And I think the fact that the Times Higher has shone the spotlight on that dynamic part of the sector is a genuine paradigm shift for the higher education sector.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.